Good morning again. We are relentlessly marching through the book of 1 John, and we've come to chapter 2, verses 7 through 11, so I'd encourage you to open up your New Testaments to that spot. We talk about the new commandment today. 1 John chapter 2, let's let the reading of the text be the first thing that I say, because that's the most important thing that I'll ever say this morning. Beloved, I am writing you no new commandment, but an old commandment that you've had from the beginning. The old commandment is the word that you've heard. At the same time, it is a new commandment that I'm writing to you, which is true in him and in you, because the darkness is passing away and the true light is already shining. Whoever says he's in the light and hates his brother is still in darkness. Whoever loves his brother abides in the light, and in him there is no cause for stumbling. But whoever hates his brother is in the darkness and walks in the darkness and does not know where he is going, because the darkness has blinded his eyes. How could something be both new and old at the same time? That's a question that we're going to address as we get into the text, but I just want us to think about the fact that on the surface level, this doesn't seem like John is making much sense. Because in one sentence, he says, I'm writing to you about something that you've had for a very long time. It's old. You already know it, and so this is not a new concept, it's brand new to anybody. But at the other hand, at the same time, this is a brand new commandment that I am writing to you about. Because the darkness is going away, and the true light is already shining in the world. And I think we're going to see that true light is talking about Jesus, and specifically, the kind of love that Jesus has shown into our lives, which gives us the power and strength to then love not just him, but love our brothers and our sisters in this community of disciples that he has put us into. And so John wants us to think about whether Jesus' love is actually in our hearts or not, because Jesus, as Hebrews 2 talks about, he was not ashamed to call us brothers. As amazing as that is. So we're gonna let that digest in our spiritual stomachs this morning and try to wrap our minds around this idea that he's talking about here in the text. So I think we can basically divide this up into a couple of different sections. 7 and 8, the first couple verses that we read together, is basically what John's doing is he's taking the law, but he's especially taking what Jesus taught and he's amplifying it. He's basically restating it and kind of blowing it up a little bit and saying this is the picture of what this whole Christian life thing is all about. So notice carefully how he works through this. In 7, when he talks about this old commandment, he's basically saying that God has always wanted his people to love. But I want you to notice the very first word of verse 7. Did you see that? Now, it's going to be different depending on which translation you're using. In the ESV that I preach and teach out of, it's going to be beloved. But if you're using a different translation, it might say something like, dear friends. And I think that's actually a better rendering, because when we say beloved, that sometimes has romantic connotations to it. There's none of that here. This is the idea of, you are my dear friend and you are special to me and I love you. That's the idea he's getting across. And since he's about to head into a discussion about love, this is a really appropriate thing for him to say, because I think he's modeling for us what it means to love your brother. Sometimes it just means saying that you do. I think it's a really important application moment for us, because on the one hand, we can have the problem of saying I love you so much and not actually meaning it. And I think later on in the book, he's going to address that problem when he says in chapter 3, verse 18, let's not just love in word and in talk. Now, let's just not throw around, man, I love you, Mo. I love you, Paula. And not actually do anything that demonstrates that. But on the other hand, you can have another problem where you just don't say it at all. And you just assume that people know that you love them, but you don't actually say it. You don't verbalize it. And I think this is just so important that as John the Apostle, as the elder statesman, wherever he is, I think he's probably in Ephesus, he's writing to these folks and he's trying to shape them, he's trying to mold them spiritually as the wise older man who has walked with Jesus. It was important for him to tell these people that he loved them and not just throw instruction in their faces. So if you are a parent and you have children, it's important for you to tell your children that you love them and not just tell them what to do and spank their bottoms. If you're an elder in the church, it's important for you to tell your sheep that you love them. If you are just a Christian here with the responsibility to look out for your other brothers and sisters, and that would be all of us, it's important for you to tell your brother and your sister that you love them. It can be sometimes so easy to think, well, my job is done if I just throw some grenades at you and then I leave the room. And I've done it. But my work is accomplished. No, it has not been. John didn't just teach them with very straight up language about how if you say this, that means you are a liar and the truth is not in you. He could say that in this letter, but at the same time he could say, but you know how much I love you. People have to understand not just the right way to think biblically, but they have to also understand that we actually care about their souls and we want to see them restored to God instead of destroyed. So he does that here. And again, he says, this is an old commandment that I'm writing to you about, beloved, dear friends. It's something that you've had from the beginning, because if you go back to the law of Moses, God has always said, I want you to love. I want you to love me, Deuteronomy 6, with everything. And I want you to also love that neighbor of yours. That's Leviticus 19. And when Jesus came, he summed up all of the law and the prophets by that command to love. He said that in Matthew chapter 22. Everything kind of hinges on that idea. And so by pairing the two together, the greatest command, the second greatest command, he says you can't have one without the other. If you want to love God, that automatically means you look out for those other people that love Jesus too. And so his readers are familiar with this concept, but verse 8, when he says, now actually though, guys, this is a new commandment that I'm writing to you about. What he's saying is, when Jesus came, that gives this idea so much of a deeper meaning that it does become new. Because the Jews, they read the law, and they understood Deuteronomy, they understood Leviticus 19, it's there in their texts, they recite it in their synagogues, and as they're walking around, but what did it actually mean? You remember Peter? Peter, good man, follower of Jesus. He went up to Jesus one time and he said, so how many times do I actually have to forgive my brother before I can just cross, draw the line in the sand and say, you've crossed this, that's it for you. And you remember Jesus got the question from the lawyer, okay, yeah, I got to love my neighbor, but who's my neighbor? Yeah, I don't really know who that's talking about. Is that, just the nice, friendly, good Jew who does nice things for me? Is that other people? So Jesus came to clear away all the cobwebs about why that, is hard to understand for some people. And so what he told Peter is, yes, you forgive your brother as many times as he needs you to, As long as he comes and says, you know, I need you to overlook what I have done, you go to your brother and you tell him that he is forgiven. When he answered the lawyer, he says, your neighbor is anybody who needs your help. Even if they're on the other side of the fence racially or culturally, like in the Good Samaritan parable, you got the Jews and you got the Samaritan there who does the right thing. Love means sacrificing your comfort, your time, your energy for somebody else, even when that somebody else cannot pay you back in the way that you have given to them. Either because they lack the ability to do that, or they lack the maturity to do that. But that's what love means. And after he explained all these things, Jesus went to the cross. And he showed how this was true in such an enormous kind of level. His back was ripped apart by Roman whips, and he was nailed to a piece of wood until he died for sins that he did not commit. And all the while that was happening, his enemies set up lawn chairs like it was Monday Night Football, and they relished watching every last breath leave his body before he finally went limp like a dead fish. That is love. You're not going to read that in the stories of Abraham in Genesis. You're going to get glimpses of it, but you're not going to read that. You're not going to read that when you go to the stories of David. As great a king as he was, man after God's own heart, you're going to get glimpses of it, but you're not going to see that love of God with all of your heart and loving your neighbor as yourself until you get to the Gospels. It is the coming of Jesus and the love in his life that truly showed what those Old Testament laws were all about. That's why this is a new commandment, not just an old one. And so in the next couple verses, in this second section, 9 through 11, what he's going to do is he's going to say, okay, are you showing love in your life? Because whether or not you're doing that or not is going to show whether you are actually in the light or you're walking in the darkness. And well, he's going to be very frank with these people that if you hate your brother, then that's an indicator that you're not in the light. You know, John really likes black and white language. Have you noticed that about him? You know, earlier on, we studied in this book how he says there's only two ways to walk. You can walk in the light, or you can be in the dark, and there's not anything in between. So here he's saying, either hate your brother, or you love your brother. There's none of this wishy-washy, well, you know, he's not my favorite person in the world, but, you know, we have some cordial exchanges once in a while. No, you either hate your brother, or you love your brother. He's just, there's no two ways to walk, there's no other thing that he says about that. It's one or the other camp. And that's really helpful because, let's be honest, we're good at justifying ourselves, aren't we? We're really good about doing that. And so when I read this language, I don't know about you, but I am really tempted to distance myself from this hatred language. I think if I was in the room when John was actually writing this, I would probably say, John, that's a really strong word to use. Hate my brother? I don't hate my brother. I may not like him especially much, and maybe I'm just a little too busy to reach out to my brothers in my life right now because of what I've got going on, but I don't hate my brother. You know, yes, I do live like a hermit. You know, just kind of wrapped up with my own concerns and, you know, COVID-19 after all, right? Gotta keep to myself. But I don't hate my brother. You know, do I know what their needs are? Not really. Have I done much lately to try to initiate and reach out and find out how I can serve and help? Well, no, not really. But I don't hate my brother. When announcements are made at the church, boy, I pay close attention when that list is read off until it leaves my mind 5 minutes later. But I don't hate my brother. Do you see how we can play games with this language? John's not letting us off the hot seat here. We either relate to people rightly or we don't. We are in every act, we are either loving our brother or we are sinning against him. And if sinning is the general path that we take, we cannot claim to live in the light with Jesus. This is strong language. And instead of excusing ourselves, instead of justifying, instead of trying to step back from this stark contrast that he's putting in front of us, let's just soak in this long enough to try to see our own lives, to see if this really is true of us, that we are in the dark instead of in the light. What I want to do now is take a little bit of a jaunt to a side road before we get into the next couple verses, because he talks a lot about brothers in this text. I want to talk about how people in the ancient world looked at brothers and sisters for just a moment, because I think this is really important. Did you know that in the New Testament time period that this letter was written in, and especially when we're talking about just the New Testament letters and how we talk about Christians, the most common way, by far, for Christians to talk about other Christians was to call them brothers or sisters. Do you know how people thought about siblings in the ancient world? Maybe you didn't grow up very close to your siblings. Maybe you did have brothers and sisters living in your house, and you didn't have much to do with them. Maybe they did eat at the same table. Maybe they slept in the next room next to you, but you didn't really have a really close relationship with them. They're just kind of there. In America, we talk about sibling rivalry a lot as just kind of a normal thing. It was not normal in the ancient world at all. It was strongly denounced. And in fact, one person that I read in trying to get ready for this sermon said this, that in the Greek and Roman worlds, the relationship between siblings is the closest and strongest and most intimate of relationships in the ancient world. Does that blow your mind or what? Even closer than a typical marriage? Yes, in the way that they looked at this. Now, I know that as Americans, we can't really relate to that very well, but that was the case. In fact, in hearing about what Ms. Dawn Small talked about in her ladies' lecture a couple of months ago, I believe that she taught a similar thing in what she's researched. So this is really powerful. Let's just think about some of the words of people that lived in ancient cultures. This is Aristotle. He was a famous philosopher. He wrote a lot of things about a lot of things. But he also wrote about ethics and about relationships. And this is what he said. Brothers, love each other as being born of the same parents, for their identity with them makes them identical with each other, which is the reason why people talk of being of the same blood or the same stock and so on. They are therefore, in a sense, the same thing. The same thing. Those separate individuals. And this is coming from a guy who lived more than 300 years before Jesus was born. Here's another guy. This guy comes a little bit after the time of Jesus. He's also a Greek man, a philosopher named Plutarch. He said, insofar as nature has made siblings separate in their bodies, so far do they become united in their emotions and actions, and share with each other their studies and recreations and games. Here's another quote that I didn't actually get on a slide. This is something also that he said. Fathers do not find such pleasure in seeing their sons gaining a reputation as orators, acquiring wealth, or holding office, as in seeing that they love one another. In other words, it was more important for ancient dads to see their kids united with each other than it was to see their kids get into really good schools and get really good jobs and pile up a lot of money and a lot of houses and a lot of slaves and servants. That is amazing, because that's not like our culture at all. In our culture, a dad is going to sit his kid down and say, you really need to think about which school to get into. You need to think about all these steps you need to take for your career and your life. And getting along with siblings is kind of low on the priority totem pole. But it was at the top in their culture. All this to say, when John says you need to love your brother, you need to love your sister, you need to look at your spiritual fellow disciples as siblings in a family, this is the kind of weight that's attached to this. And so even if you aren't very close to your physical brother and sister growing up, this is how we need to retrain our minds when we read New Testament letters. Because this is how they thought about this. Anyway, just thought I'd share that. That's been powerful to me to think about. So verse 10. Remaining in the light, John says, that means living with fellow believers as God intends. Look carefully at the end of this verse. How do we do this? What is it that makes us live with each other the right kind of way that God would be pleased with? End of the verse in verse 10 says, in him there is no cause for stumbling. What does that mean? Well, going back to the words of Jesus, Jesus talked about this. Remember in Luke 17, first part of Luke 17, where he says to his disciples, temptations to sin are sure to come, but woe to the one through whom they come. It would be better for him if a millstone were hung around his neck and he were cast into the sea, than that he should cause one of these little ones to sin. And then the next couple verses after those talk about how you had better not withhold forgiveness from your brother, and you had better generously offer him the olive branch whenever he is ready for it. Because if you don't, if we keep bitterness locked up in our hearts, if we do not forgive, then our brother not only has to deal with his own sin, he's also got to process and try to deal with him the right way, the fact that we are angry at him when we should not be. So how much thought do we actually give to the way that our words and our actions affect our other brothers and sisters? This is a serious business that God's calling us to think about. And so the last verse that we're going to look at... Are we still...
Yeah, we're down.
Okay. Right. Well, look at verse 11 here. We're just going to plow on. The true nature of a hater. Somebody who hates his brother. What's his condition? Where is he? What's he like? John is really straight up with us and says that guy is completely blind. He cannot see anything spiritually at all. That's how important it is to get this loving brother and sister thing right. Because if we don't, we just flat out do not have any kind of relationship with God. We don't have a clue about what it means to actually serve our God, because this love business is everything about what he was about. This reminds me so much of 1 Corinthians 13. Do you remember when Paul starts out that chapter, before he gets into love means this, love means that, you know how he sets that up? If I speak in the tongues of men and of angels, but I don't have love, I'm just a noisy gong, I'm just a clanging cymbal. If I have prophetic powers, and I understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have all faith so as to remove mountains, which Jesus said, you should have faith that lets you remove mountains. So I've got that faith, but I don't have love. I am nothing. Not just, I'm something with some kinks to iron out. I'm nothing. And if I give away all that I have, and if I deliver up my body to be burned, and I become a martyr for the faith, and people write about me in history books, but I don't have love, I gain nothing. Where else in the Bible do you ever read of a characteristic as important as love is? I don't think you do. And in fact, I think we mentioned this in this morning's class. You go down to the end of 1 Corinthians 13, and Paul actually compares love to two other characteristics that we've got to have as Christians. We've got to have faith. We've got to have hope. That's commanded. But love, he says, eclipses them all. It's the greatest. Because it defines what God does for us and how we should treat each other. So what we're confronted with as we try to wrap our minds around this whole section that we've read and studied this morning about this old commandment that's actually a new commandment when you put it in terms of what Jesus has done, we got to ask ourselves, are we like Jesus in how we live with each other? Because again, going back to Hebrews 2, like I mentioned at the very beginning, this is what the Bible teaches about how he looks at us. He is not ashamed to call them brothers. Hebrews chapter 2, verse 11. And I always stumble over this when I read this, because doesn't he have plenty of reasons why he should be ashamed of me and of you? But he's not. Why is he not ashamed of us? Well, what does that verse say? He who sanctifies, Jesus, and those who are sanctified, us, all have one source. Jesus came from his Father. We were created by the Father. We all come from him. He is the one that unites us, and therefore we are siblings with the Savior. Is that not an incredible thought? Especially when you appreciate how they talked about brothers and sisters. Therefore, if he is willing and happy even to accept us, how are we doing with accepting each other? Do we make sacrifices for our spiritual siblings like the sacrifice that he made in giving up his life? What we're about to eat and drink this morning after this lesson is done is supposed to help remind us not just of the actual historical event of the cross, but of the fact that there has never been a moment in human history where more love has been poured out on people who did not deserve it at all. We are part of that crowd of people who are recipients of this amazing love when he gave his body and he gave his blood. And remember this morning we're talking about present your members as slaves of righteousness. Isn't that exactly what Jesus did with his members? What did he do with his body? His physical body that he embraced as he was born into our world. He allowed it to be mutilated beyond comprehension. Should we not, then, as his people, give ourselves up for each other? That's the message of the new commandment.